I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. I pray to Swami that He gives us all the understanding. It is He who speaks and it is He who listens through all of us. Sisters and brothers, Sairam, a very good morning. Just a while ago, we completed the Golden Jubilee celebrations of the Brindavan campus. It's a very different and unique experience to be a student of that particular campus. Generally, when people wish to become students of Swami, they would crave for an opportunity to spend as much time as it is possibly available with Swami. And being in Vrindavan means that for many, many months of the year, you would be away from Swami. But for those few months that Swami would come to Vrindavan, literally, Swami would make up for the rest of the year. Because Swami would give us all an opportunity, which is famously referred to as a tri session. And Swami would allow students to come into His residence, Thrai Vrindavan, sit around Him, and the way Swami would interact would be completely different from how it would be when He is outside giving darshan. So that made a stay in Vrindavan so special that throughout the year you are looking forward to that time when Swami would come to Vrindavan, and when He finally does, there will be no regrets. All the past would be forgotten. And for those of you who have seen that moment when the students would go to Thrai Vrindavan, we would come in a very orderly fashion, sit in the Sai Ramesh Hall. The Sai Ramesh Hall dais would have three doors. One door was behind Lord Krishna's idol. There was one door to the extreme left through which Swami would come and go out. There would be one door to the extreme right. And for us students, the indication that Swami has called us for a tri session is that door will be open after aarti. So you would see that all of us would get up in a very orderly fashion, go in a line and enter that door. But all orderliness is only till we enter that door. Because the moment we enter that door, there would be a mad sprint towards Thrai Vrindavan. And usually the devotees would not see that part of the tri session. So we would go in a very orderly line, and of course there would be the enthusiasm in the steps itself, the way we are walking briskly towards the door. But after that, even if you set tigers behind us, we wouldn't run so fast. We would run and go and sit in front of Swami's jula. And if you're someone who is not prepared to run, who is too old to run, or too infirm to run, you better get out of the way. Because you would certainly be knocked down. And that's precisely what happened one day to an elderly gentleman whom Swami had invited for the tri session, a senior staff member. This deluge of students running, they knocked him down. And as it would always happen, he was knocked down and he was also picked up, and the rest of them ran. So this elderly person was very angry, was very upset by this behavior, and anything could have happened, you know. There could have been a serious injury that could have caused by that. So he goes inside Thrai Vrindavan, he sits in his designated place, and he's sitting all grumpy. He's so angry. And Swami, ever so mischievously, comes into that Thrai session, looks at this elderly gentleman and says, "Today, why don't you give some advice to our boys?" He was waiting for that opportunity, literally. Swami said, "Do amara boys ko kuch advice do." So he got up and he said, "What is this, boys? Discipline is so important to Swami, and how can you all behave like this? You run like this and Swami expects so much out of you, and this is how you all behave." Swami was sitting there on the jula patiently listening to this discourse. At the end of it, Swami blessed that speaker. Swami made him sit down. And then Swami started telling, now this person, he speaks about you all running. Only Swami knows at your age after whom this person ran. Swami says, only I know whom you ran behind when you were their age. At least you should be happy that they are running for Swami. Many, many times, this is not once, this has happened on a number of occasions with different people. And Swami will say, Chepamantava, do you want me to tell them whom you ran behind? And if that was not enough, the next day again Swami comes, looks at the same devotee. Aaj kuch advice deta hai. Would you like to give any advice today? He said, Swami, please. I have given them enough. It's very interesting to say that, oh, we all ran behind God. Even in Prashantinilam, if you were sitting just before Swami's darshan, there would be so much peace, there would be so much calm, and suddenly there would be so much of reverberation around, literally like there's an earthquake, and you would see students coming running into the mandir. Oftentimes I would think, if given an opportunity, even the devotees would run like that. If the devotees ran, they wouldn't be allowed to sit there. We were allowed to run, we ran. Not only were we allowed to run, we were given a circumstance, an environment around us, where running for God was not weird. Where craving for this opportunity to be near Swami was not criticized, but was appreciated. We were brought up in a manner where doing this very, very precious thing of craving and running and aspiring to be close to God was encouraged. When we look at modern day society and when we look at the way we have led lives for many, many decades before, especially when you look at a modern family versus a family which is traditional, which is old, we tend to think that now we don't bother as much about what the people around us think about us as we used to before. In the past, you're always worried about what would the neighbor think of me? What would the other people in the village think of me? What would people in my community think of me? What would my relatives think of me? We more or less, I think, would agree that today we are not as much bothered like before. Now, what others think of us, the opinion that others have of us, seems to be far less important now than before. But the fact is, we live in a time where the craving for pure acceptance is in an all-time high. It's just that it's in a different form. At least if it is not higher than before, it is quite high and higher than we care to acknowledge. We still continue to lead our lives looking around and thinking, what is the other person thinking of me? In the past, we were only bothered about the 10 families around us, the 20 families who knew us, or probably the 100 people in the village who were around us. But today, in the world of connectivity and networking and social networking, there are hundreds of thousands of people we connect with, and now we are bothered about what all of those people are thinking about us. The craving for pure acceptance is literally gone beyond the roof. The problem with leading a life worried about what is the other person thinking of me? Oh, I should do things this way, otherwise the person will talk like this about me. The problem about living life like that is that we, over a period of time, start living a hypocritical life. We become what we are really not, or we pretend to be whom we are not. And that's why it's always spoken of, you know, don't bother about what others think of you. It's something which even our parents have told us, even modern society always tells us that we should not be bothered about what others think of us. We should not be bothered about pleasing others. There was this senior of mine who had gone to an institute in Bangalore when he was doing his MBA project. They would allow us to go to libraries and institutions outside to access journals and books that we didn't have in our library. And during the summer, we were allowed to go there. So there was this senior of mine who had gone to this very famous institution in Bangalore. So he went to the library. It was huge. He was going around and he was not able to find a particular book that he was looking for. He looked around, there was nobody else there except for, there was a young girl who was sitting at a table and she was reading something. So this boy just walks up to her and says, "Excuse me, sister, can you just help me find this particular book? Where should I look for it?" This girl looked up and gave a very stunned look. And she said, "What did you say?" And he said, he repeated the name of the book and he said, "I'm looking for this book." She said, "No, what did you call me?" He said, "I said, excuse me, sister." And then she said, "This is the first time I've been on this campus for so many years, someone is addressing me as sister." And then for the next few minutes, this girl started pouring out her woes. She said, "I come from a traditional family. The kind of dress I'm wearing is not the kind of dress I would otherwise wear. The way I speak, the way I carry myself, the things I eat are not things that I would eat otherwise. I am forced to do all this because otherwise I would not be accepted in the environment here." And she was so thrilled that somebody was coming and addressing her as sister, like otherwise how we are probably all trained to interact with each other. So when we say that we are in a situation where the desire for peer acceptance is at an all-time high, and when we say that we are now not bothered about what others think of us, I think there's a different, there's a disparity between the two. As I said, when you look at social media, this hypocrisy that I'm talking of has been taken to a completely different level. You have youngsters who are constantly posting inspirational messages on social media, but unknown to all, they're actually becoming very, very hopeless. Nobody comes and speaks to them and nobody is trying to encourage them or get them out of it because nobody knows. You're constantly posting messages of hope. Who would guess that you're actually hopeless? There are people who are posting pictures of them smiling, what we refer to as selfies, but unknown to everybody else, they're actually sinking into depression. And all of a sudden, we see that every other day we hear some news like that. Celebrities, youngsters who become very famous, who suddenly take their life. And for the rest of the world, it's all of a sudden, because till yesterday you were posting pictures of you smiling. So when we say that, when we get into this trap of what others think of us, becomes very important to me, and we start leading a hypocritical life. Couple that with this new trend of we connecting to hundreds of thousands of people around the world. The connections have become intercontinental. It is no more within a certain economic strata. We connect with people who are richer than us. We connect with people who are poorer than us, over different races, over different countries. It becomes all the more complex and we run a risk of leading an extremely hypocritical life. So this being the case, I think I've fairly established that we have not outgrown this idea or this necessity to act in a manner that people around us approve. It has only taken a different form now. So having established that, probably it is worthwhile to go back and see, why is it that we crave for this pure acceptance? Why is it that we crave for leading life in a manner that people around us will approve of it? The first few years after Facebook had launched, one of the marketing pitches that Facebook presented was, you are going to be connected to people like never before. Till now you had friends who were in your neighborhood, in your school, in your college, but now you can have friends across the globe. They said, we're going to create a global village where everyone is connected to everybody else. And if you go onto Facebook, you can connect to at least 5,000 people. Right? So they said that you can connect to so many more people than you ever can. So at one point, when they had, I think, about 40 to 50 million users on Facebook, Facebook did a study. On an average, how many people does one user connect to? You've given them the opportunity to connect to 5,000 people, but how many people do they really connect to? And they found that the average number is roundabouts 150. It's about 120, 130, but they said that a few is left out for connecting to those people who are still not on Facebook. So on an average, an individual connects to about 100 to 150 people and has an active conversation or active connect with not more than 10 or 20 people. So when this number came up, that 150 people is the mean average number of people who can be maintained in a circle, the anthropologist jumped at that number because for them it was a very significant number they had been speaking about for a very long time. It's referred to as a Dunbar number. When they studied different species, primates, other species like horses and mules, deers, they were seeing how many individuals are there in a group that these different species form. So when they started plotting this idea of how many individuals are there in a group which a monkey forms and a chimpanzee forms and orangutan forms, they found an uncanny correlation between the size of the brain and the number of people there can be in a group. And when they say a size of the brain, it's not about the weight or it's not about the volume of the brain, but the cognitive abilities of the brain. So when they did this plotting of this graph, correlating the brain's capacity to the number of people whom you tend to interact with, they extrapolated it and said, in human beings, that number is 150. So for us to have a good social life, at any point in our lifetime, we connect, interact, and have a good exchange with not more than 150 people. So when it came to the animals, the groups were always 150. It was never more than that. But now if we look at the human species, yes, probably on Facebook I might be connected to 150 people, but I can look at 1.3 billion people and say, we are all the same. We belong to the same country. Where is the 150 and where is 1.3 billion? Or we can look at 7 billion people and say, we all are one humanity. We can connect to such a large number, which is never seen in any other species. So when they studied ancient man, what they realized is, there are three things which happened which made him a force to reckon with. He managed to form groups which were larger than 150. Even though each individual would interact with 150, he could form groups larger than 150. And he could spread across regions much, much farther than any other group of 150 or 100 or 50 could spread around. So they found out, they wanted to see what gave this ability to this species. Very interestingly, they zero it down to three things, and all those three things are based on one thing. What is that one thing? The ability to speak. The ability to convey something, an idea, a scene that you have seen, a description, much, much more clearly than any other species could. They say a baboon can come into the group and say, there is danger there. There is food there. But when a human being came into his tribe, he could say, there is food there is this much food, there is this danger, but there is another path you can go around to get that food. So the ability to describe scenes more descriptively, more accurately, gave this group the ability to cross horizons which other species could not. And the second thing, which probably we'll leave it for another day, I'll just mention it, the ability to speak about fiction. Or the ability to speak about things which have not been seen. So now they could speak about common deities. They could speak about a guardian angel. They could speak about the concept of a tribe, nationhood, of we being one caste, one community, one religion. All of this came from, there is an abstract topic, the ability to talk about it, describe it, and pass it on, which no other species, they believe, had. And the third thing, which is going to be important for our topic today, is the ability to describe another person's nature. A human being could describe another person. He has ill temper. This person is trustable. This person is friendly. This person is very hostile. The ability to describe the nature of another person became very, very critical in forming larger groups. So now, if I know 150 people and say any one of you is one of those people, and you know 149 other people, I can now know 149 more people just because I know you, and you can describe those people to me. So this ability to know people increases, and that is how groups started becoming larger and larger. And when we talk about the ancient man in the wild, he was under enormous disadvantage because he did not have claws, he did not have fangs, he did not have wings, his feet were not fast enough to take him away from danger. So when in such disadvantage, he had to rely heavily upon the community which was formed. Man's survival depended on his ability to stick together. And if you want to stick together, you better have a good name. Right? Because if you have to be in the group, it's all about social transactions. It's all about business. It's all about you interacting with the other person, be it as a mate or as a friend or as an ally. So this made your reputation very, very critical. So when today we say that without our knowledge, unconsciously, we are worried about what the other person thinks of us, it is actually born out of a survival instinct. And that is why it is so difficult to get over. It cannot be removed just by choosing to do it, because it is so deeply ingrained in us. But the beauty of this whole pressure that we are all put in, you're put in a society, you're put in a community, and you constantly have to think what the other person thinks of me. The pressure that it created ensured that you will stick to the right path. It became a very strong deterrent against adharma. And Swami would oftentimes say, Sangha Niti is very important. The rules that a community puts together is always for the larger good. You may like it, you may not like it. Left alone, you may want to follow it, you may not want to follow it. But in the group, for the group dynamics to work, to follow that Sangha Niti becomes very, very important. And that is what Dharma is all about mostly. Apart from the basic morality that we can talk about, otherwise Dharma is all about, in India we drive left. That is the Dharma in India. I cannot follow the same Dharma in the US. There are different ways by which a society comes to a set of rules to say that this is what all of us will follow so that there is order in society. And when reputation is at stake, you will stick to doing the right thing. So in many ways, this peer pressure or this desire to be accepted by the people around us became a very important tool to keep us on the right path. A couple of years earlier, I was visiting my brother who lives in London, and we had gone to a restaurant. There's this very interesting, I mean, of course, if you're all the time, you've been born and brought up in India or in any of our cities here, you would find this interesting. Otherwise, you would find it common. You go to a restaurant, the lady or the man who's going to serve you that evening would come up to your table and introduce themselves with their name. They'll say, I am so-and-so and I'm going to be your host for this evening. And basic etiquette demands that you remember that name and call that person by name every time you want something. In India, we're not used to that. So we had gone to this particular restaurant, this person came and she was serving us. I was talking with my brother and she had come to the table and she said, can I clear your table? So we were in the middle of a conversation, so I just gestured, not very impolitely, but out of habit, I just gestured and she left the plate and she walked away. And immediately my brother looked at me and said, don't ever do that again. He said, because it is considered very rude here. You must make eye contact and say that, not yet, please, I'll take some more time. If you look at it, it is a very, very beautiful value which is being followed. That you respect each individual, whatever that person may be doing, but respect that individual as a human being, as an equal. But that value was being enforced on you by this peer pressure around. Because if I don't do that, people around me are looking at what an uncultured person this is. You cannot write a law to enforce this. The government cannot say that if you do this behavior, we're going to arrest you. But this peer pressure around can ensure that I follow a simple thing like this, which is actually a cultured form of living. And in fact, Swami himself would refer to some of these etiquettes. Swami would say, these are things that you should learn from Westerners. I don't know how far it is being carried on into the next generation now, but hopefully it is. Swami would say this politeness, the way you talk to everyone, whether or not that person is equal to you or below you in status. So this Sangha Niti, or this pressure of people around you expecting something out of you, can keep you on the right path. If we were to lead our lives thinking that I am absolutely not bothered about what the others think of me, you will be labeled as insane, right? If there is an individual in society who leads his life in a manner saying that what others think of me does not matter to me at all, you'll only be behaving like a mad person. There's a very beautiful padyam, a Sanskrit shloka, which I'm sure many, many times we all would have heard it in Swami's discourses. Swami sings that, he says, Astiram jivanam loke, astiram yavanam dhanam. Astiram jivanam loke, astiram yavanam dhanam. Astiram dhara putradi, satyam Kirti Dvayam Stiram. Astiram Jivanam Loke. In this world, life is transient. Astiram Yavanam Danam. In this life, in this world, youth and wealth is transient. It comes and goes. Astiram Dara Putradi. Your family, your children, your wife, your progeny, people around you, they all are transient. The final statement Swami makes is, Satyam Kirti Dvayam Stiram. Truth and reputation is not transient. Whenever I would hear this, I would find this a little contradictory to our understanding of spirituality. Swami is saying Satyam and Kirti are constant. Billions of people have lived on the face of this planet, and I'm sure many of them have been great achievers, have done many noble things. But how many do we really remember? Is it that all of their Kirti has become eternal and we remember each one of them? Then why is Swami saying Satyam Kirti Dvayam Stiram? My understanding of this particular shloka that Swami sings is, when you say Stiram, it means that which is stable, that which is firm. When we are trying to lead our lives, we want to reference this life against something that is more stable. When I want to write something, I need a stable platform to keep my paper and write. Say if I want to build a wall, the person comes and asks me, so how high the wall should be built? I tell him, okay, build it 6 feet high. What we refer to as 1 foot is a standard. It does not change. 1 foot here is the same as 1 foot in Bangalore. So we always look for something which is standard, which is fixed, to reference our life. So now when you look at this particular shloka that Swami says, Astiram Jivanam Loke, life itself is transient, so you cannot come up with the moral way of living based on life. Astiram Yavanam Danam, your youth and your wealth cannot determine how you should lead your life. They are not good reference points. Dara Putradi, your family and your connections with people around, is not a good reference point. Satyam Kirti Dvayam Stiram. If you want to reference your life and lead your life in a certain manner, either reference it on the reputation or reference it on truth. So those people, and Swami of course is very, very quick to explain this. When you say Kirti, Kirti is not going viral on the internet, right? The modern days, that Kirti is definitely transient. There's no doubt about that. Swami would give this example. Swami would give the example of the state of Bengal. Swami would say that so many intellectuals and so many scientists and so many great politicians and rulers have come from that state of Bengal. But he said, but when you tell me West Bengal, I think of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. I think of Vivekananda. Why is it that they have earned eternal space in our memory? And Swami would say, it's because of good character. And Swami goes on to say, Kirti is always a reward for good character. In the first Vahini, Prema Vahini, Swami says, you might wonder, but in today's society, the right values are not celebrated. Swami says, that society that does not give importance to values is not worth being called a society at all. I am only referring to such society which gives value to truth. So when we say Satyam Kirti Dvayam Stiram, and Kirti, your reputation, or what people think of us, to keep a tab on the gossip, what people talk of us behind us. If that can become a good reference point for our life, we must ensure that that kirti itself is based on truth or based on values like satya, dharma, shanti, prema. As we go through life, one thing which is very, very important for all of us is what we refer to as self-respect. We often see this. Individuals who lose the will to live or get into a depression, it's not because people around them have started hating them. We have seen a lot of people who survive such hostile environment too. But when you start losing respect for yourself, that is when you start falling. So self-confidence and self-respect, Swami would say, is very, very important for us to lead this life. And Swami would say, when you talk about the self, you're not one but three. The one others think you are, the one you think you are, and the one you really are. And now when you talk about self-respect, respect is what others give you. Self-respect is the respect that you give yourself. But now when I talk of my self-respect, much of that depends on the way others look at me. That becomes very important for me. It is not wrong completely, but the kind of people that you choose to give importance to is the determining factor. Now let us say I form around me such company which respects the right kind of values. Now the pressure of them being around me and the pressure of trying to get a good name in this community that I want to relate to will ensure that I do the right actions, right? I will make moral decisions, I will speak the truth, I will be kind, I will be compassionate. But when I do these things, Swami says these are all qualities which are born out of the truth that you are the real self. And the more I start doing this, the more without my knowledge, I am gravitating towards my true self. So now when I say self-respect, it is a mixture of what I think I am, a mixture of what I think others think of me, and there is this unknown aspect of my true self which probably I don't acknowledge as often. But when I put this pressure on myself by gathering around me the right kind of people, I will do more actions which are born out of this true self. There was this, I don't know, I've mentioned this before. There was this small girl who probably was an 8-year-old, 9-year-old girl who once asked me this brilliant question as part of our radio program. Girl who's from the United States who said, "My SSC teacher tells me that you should not judge others. But my teacher also tells me avoid bad company. How can I avoid bad company if I'm not allowed to judge another person?" It's a brilliant question, isn't it? How can I avoid bad company if I'm not allowed to judge you as good or bad? It's a very thought-provoking question. The answer to that is very simple. You do not judge the other person, you judge yourself in the other person's company. When in the other person's company are you doing the right thing? Then that person has good company. When in the company of the other person are you ending up doing the wrong thing, then the other person is bad company. So you're not judging the other person, but you're constantly judging your own actions, which is definitely permitted by Swami. So when we say kirti and satyam, and when we start with kirti, this kirti can take us both ways. If we fill our lives with the wrong company, we will be made to do actions which take us away from satya, away from our true self. And Swami says, over a period of time, you will lose respect for yourself. And this has happened with so many individuals, right? When you come and sit in front of Swami, it is like you become an open book to yourself. And when you become an open book to yourself, if you've done the wrong things, you look at yourself and you're ashamed of yourself. And it has happened with so many people, those who have led lives which were filled with corruption, filled with malpractices. When they come in front of Swami, one darshan Swami turns and goes away, instantly they feel, I've done this mistake, that's why Swami is treating me like this. On the other hand, when you start doing the right thing, and when your self-respect is born out of doing the right thing, Swami says, you will see the value of that and you will not trade it for anything ever. But in the absence of that, we will not be able to face Swami. But when you start doing the right thing, those right actions are actually born out of Satya. And when you say Satyam and Kirti can be used as a reference, over a period of time, the Kirti can be forgotten. Because as Swami says, Kirti is actually a byproduct of you leading a good life. If you constantly do the right thing, if you constantly lead a noble life, automatically Kirti will come. So you start off with Kirti, start off by seeing whether people around me are giving me the right respect. You will end up doing the right actions. And eventually when your self-respect starts growing in confidence out of the true self, eventually you will find that you don't have to hold on to this Kirti. But it is all in the mind, right? What others think of me, most often it is only in my mind. But still it is important. Because if I start leading my life thinking that I don't bother about what others think of me, I'm going to lead a mindless life. That's why if you see an insane person, that's why if you see a person who has lost his mental balance, they're not wearing clean clothes, they speak anything, they lie anywhere, they're not well kept. Why? Because this critical idea of it is important for me what others think of me is removed in a very unnatural manner. I jump into a swimming pool with a swimming vest, and let's say a friend of mine is there who's a champion swimmer, who jumps into the pool and says, hey, you should not be wearing a vest, take off the vest and swim without a vest. And if I were to take his name and take his word for it and take off my vest, I will only drown. But there is a process by which I can learn to swim without the vest, and that I should endeavor for. Yes, Kirti has to be given up. Yes, this botheration, constant botheration of what others think of me has to be given up, but in a slow process. And isn't that why Swami says, satsangatve nissangatvam? Nissanga means the ability to be in solitude. Swami says, you cannot one fine day wake up and say, I don't want any company. Swami say, you start with satsanga. That sangha which establishes you in the sat. You start with satsanga, and that satsanga will lead you to nissanga. And that, of course, as Swami says, which will take you on to satsangate nissangatvam, nissangatve nirmohatvam. You will eventually reach that state of desirelessness and nirmohatve nischalatatvam and thereon. In other words, we can make use of this nature of ours to be under peer pressure if we are able to put the right kind of peer pressure around ourselves. And if we were to really look at it, isn't that what Swami has done for thousands and thousands of youth around the globe today? Thousands of youth are following the right path because of positive peer pressure, which Swami has created in the form of the Satya Sai organization, in the form of the Sai youth group, where they're all connecting with each other. I was speaking to an elderly gentleman from Australia who has teenage children, and he was telling that I have no problem with my children because they are participating in all the activities of the organization. Week after week, they go for bhajans. Because if they don't go for bhajans, their friends will call up and ask, hey, what happened? Why didn't you turn up? Literally like how when you hang out with friends and you don't turn up, you have the pressure from them. You know, people don't want you to become good if you're in bad company. If you're trying to transform your bad habits, your company will try to push you down back. Because if I am friends with somebody who smokes, and if that fellow gets this, let's say both of us smoke, and that fellow gets this brilliant idea that he has to quit smoking, not only is he becoming a good person, but he's showing me in poor light. So I start protesting. I say, no, you should not give up smoking. But when we talk about positive peer pressure, it works exactly the other way around. Now, thousands of youth are saying, no, I have to go for bhajans, because if I don't go for bhajans, my friends will think wrong of me. If I don't turn up for seva, what will they think of me? Yes, it has the risk of making us hypocritical. But as I said, when that kirti makes you do good actions, eventually that satsanga will lead you to nissanga, which means you will be good even in the absence of such company around. That is what is nissanga all about. Your ability to stick to values even in the absence of people who ensure that you are sticking to values. Right? That's what nissanga or solitude is all about. And even as we speak, I keep seeing posts on the internet, on Facebook and other social media. I think Sai Youth of Zone 1, they're doing a conference, a very interesting name. It's called Dare to be Divine. Can you imagine teenagers of their age coming from a Western modern society thinking of such things? Dare to be divine. Let's become the divinity we really are. 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds thinking of such things. It is because of the networking that Swami has created, using the same things which are spoiling us. The social networking is ruining our next few generations, but using the same techniques, Swami is literally bringing back all these youth together. In being in Radio Sai, we constantly get to interact and see some of these things which they do. Youth in Malaysia, we had a couple of months back, we had youth from the southeastern region, Malaysia, Indonesia. The kind of activities they're involved in on a regular basis. One of the wonderful examples is the youth of the state of Visakhapatnam. Sorry, the city of Visakhapatnam. There's a place called Paderu. I'm sure many of you must have heard the stories about this. A very small group of youngsters who probably just graduated from engineering college, or some of them still studying. This passion to do something which Swami would be proud of brought them together. They go to this interior tribal village in a place called Araku Valley, which is completely cut off. It's a very, very beautiful landscape, but completely cut off from civilization. There are hundreds and hundreds of tribal villages in different places. Can you imagine these people go there and start doing water projects for these villages which have been neglected for 70 years after independence? And who are they? Probably 5-10 young individuals coming together saying, we have to do something to please Swami. What can we do? And as of today, you wouldn't believe it, they have done water projects in over 200 villages. What the Indian government could not do, what the bodies of international welfare schemes could not do. Just a bunch of Sai youth coming together. And that is the networking which Swami has created. That is the peer pressure which Swami has created. That you get into this rut, you start doing the right things. And the same social networking channels which starts channeling you towards the right path. Probably before I conclude, I want to share another very beautiful aspect of this same topic that we're talking about. There's this particular elementary school in the United States, in South San Francisco. It's a school called Spruce Elementary School. And one fine day, a psychologist turns up to that school. His name is Professor Robert Rosenthal. So he comes and discusses with all these teachers, and he says, "No, I've come up with a very advanced IQ test. It is more reliable than the IQ test that we have now. And we would love your elementary school children to take this test." So the teachers agreed. So they were all given this test. A couple of days later, Professor Rosenthal comes back and he gives a list of students in each class. And he says that these students have excelled in this test, which means they are going to be phenomenally intelligent when they grow up. It may not show now, and he said that's the speciality of this test, that what the other IQ tests do not come up with, this particular test can dig out. So he says that watch out for these students, they're going to excel. So then this list was given to the class teachers. So the class teachers each of the class teachers look at this list, and they find these students as pretty normal compared to the other students in the class. But now they have this added information that these are very smart kids. So a couple of years later, Professor Rosenthal comes again to the same school and he says, "Can we do the IQ test again?" And they find that almost each one of those students identified in the previous test have shown enormous growth in their IQ levels. But the most interesting part was what Professor Rosenthal revealed after that. The IQ test that he gave the class was like any other normal IQ test. And the second thing is, the list that he made of students was a very, very random pick. It was not that they were intelligent. It was not that there was any spark of intelligence revealed in the test. He randomly picked a few students from the class and he said, "These are the brilliant ones." But each one of the students eventually did go on to excel. And this particular test was done in different scenarios in different schools. And that's how he came up with an effect or a theory called the Pygmalion effect. It was called the Pygmalion effect, and it has been applied and studied in various scenarios, like in corporations, in the military, in training modules, and all of that. The idea of this Rosenthal theory that he propagated was that when you have an expectation out of an individual, that somehow causes that individual to excel. It's a very interesting theory. When you have a certain high expectation of an individual, you tend to behave with that individual in a certain manner, and somehow that behavior seems to influence that ability of that person to excel. This is what is referred to as the Pygmalion effect. Now, if you look at it, how many discourses Swami would have stood there and spoken so grandly about Swami's students? "Oh, my Swami, my students are like this, my students are like that." And he made this whole Sai community look at students as, "These are the guys. These are the ones who are going to come and redeem the society." Whether it's true or it's not true, I don't know. But imagine the enormous Pygmalion effect that must have had on each one of us. Not only students, when Swami addressed all of us, when we were all as devotees, when Swami spoke to us, Swami expected much higher from each one of us than probably anybody else was not initiated into the Sai circle, isn't it? And without our knowledge, even those who are not devotees of Swami look at Sai devotees and expect much, much more from us than they expect from any other people. And this is something that many of our students have faced. There are people who are not devoted to Swami, there are people who have no association or no interaction with Swami's institutions. But the moment you say you're a Sai devotee, they expect more from you. And wouldn't that itself cause an enormous Pygmalion effect on us and make us do better than we can? So when Swami has labeled us Sai devotee, Sai student, Sai youth, it is this effect one which is acting upon us. And the other thing which without our knowledge starts acting upon our mind is, the mind has a very interesting function, or it's meant to do that. It's meant to protect you. The mind is meant for self-preservation. The mind, which is represented by the brain in the body, the brain is meant for self-preservation of this body. Similarly, the mind is meant for self-preservation of this being. So when I say the mind is going to try to preserve the self, the next question is, what is the idea of self that you are giving the mind to protect? If I'm going to think I'm only this body, the mind will protect that idea. Which means I'll become selfish. If there's food in front of me, I'll grab. I will not be bothered about others. If there's a danger, I will just take care of myself. Now I give a more advanced idea of this self to this mind. I say I'm not only this body. So and so is my family. This is my child. Now this mind tries to protect this new idea of the self that you have given the mind. So when there is a danger, you try to protect your family. When there is a danger, you try to protect those who are dependent on you. And now we make this idea of the self even more complex by saying, I belong to this community. I belong to this country. I belong to this race. So the mind starts trying to protect each one of these identities. Swami steps in, and what does Swami say? Swami says, you are Swami's devotee. In a discourse, Swami would say, tell yourself, I am not an animal, I am a man. Tell yourself, I am not any man, I am a Sai devotee. Why? Because when we repeat to ourselves, I am a Sai devotee, I am a Sai student, I am a Sai youth, I am a Sai whatever, office bearer, whatever it is. Now the mind starts trying to protect this identity that you have given it. So in forming this entire network of individuals all around the globe who are united under one name, you know, devotees of Swami or Sai youth, or Sai organization, Swami is doing all of these three things. He is putting us in a path of positive peer pressure, where we are, as I said in the beginning, I wouldn't have run after God if I was anywhere else. I did it here. I ran for Swami here. I'm not sure if I would do it anywhere else. Sitting in the Sai Kulwanthal, I sing my throat out when I'm singing bhajans. I'm not sure if I'm sitting in a bus somewhere in New York, I would do the same thing. So one way Swami has put us in the right kind of peer pressure where we are doing the right thing. And the second thing is this enormous Pygmalion effect is working on all of us, where the entire society around us is looking at and expecting more out of us. And because they're expecting more, they treat us in a certain way. And because of that, without our knowledge, we are excelling more than we would have otherwise done. And Swami has given us this new identity. Not only are you this body, not only are you this personality, not only are you this family and all of this, but now you say, I am a Swami's devotee. It's a challenge to your mind to protect this identity now. Right? Because the moment Swami says that you belong to me, now it becomes the mind's duty to ensure that I belong to Swami. I have to protect this identity of Swami. And this is what has kept so many devotees, and students and young people on the right track. Probably to conclude, there's this very, very beautiful passage. I've not got it here and maybe I will not be able to read it out. When Swami Vivekananda went to Chicago, when he was speaking about Vedanta, he makes a very, very beautiful point. He says, I come from a religion, I come from Sanatana Dharma, which refuses to call you a sinner, which refuses to call you men and women, My Sanatana Dharma refers to me as children of immortal bliss, Amritasya Putraha. And he says, permit me to call you all the children of immortal bliss. If you look at it, that is the identity which has been given to an individual and say, now protect this identity. Now live up to this identity. So each time when Swami said Prema Swarupalara, Swami said Divyatma Swarupalara, and Swami said Bhaktulara, Swami was giving us an identity to protect, to live by, to keep up that name. Start with Kirti and automatically you will go towards Satyam. And when you come towards Satyam, you will not need that support system around you to protect you. As once when Swami was giving a discourse, Swami picked out one of the students and started praising him to the sky. Swami said, oh, he's a great devotee, he's this person, he's that person. And Swami starts praising, you will feel like hiding somewhere. I still recall one of the students, Swami pointed at him and Swami was praising one particular act that he had done. Swami just sent some vibhuti to that boy, to a devotee who was ailing in Bombay. So from Vrindavan, Swami gave him vibhuti and Swami said, take the flight, go to Bombay, give it in the hospital to this devotee and come back. And that's all that boy did. And when he comes back, an entire discourse Swami is praising this boy. Swami is saying, he's a great fellow, he's this, he's that. And Swami says, you know, even Hanuman did more than what Rama asked him to do. He's better than Hanuman. When Swami starts praising like that, you feel like hiding somewhere. So one such discourse, when Swami picked out one particular boy and started praising him, he's a great jnani, he's a great saint. And this boy didn't know where to keep his face. And after the discourse, he went up to Swami and said, Swami, why did you say all those things? You know as well as I do that I am none of that. Because only Swami and you are the witness to the nonsense that you do, isn't it? So he said, Swami, I'm none of what you said. Why did you say that? And very casually, Swami said, oh, you're not any of that. You're not like that. Try to be. That's all. You know, the reputation has been sent ahead of you. Now live up to it. So I think that is what Swami was doing to each one of us. Putting us in this larger picture and putting this undue peer pressure on us to be good, to be noble, to march towards our truth. So with those few words, I thank you all for your very, very patient listening. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet.